I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, an American community slowly poisoned by toxic levels of lead in its tap water. We'll look into what happened in Flint, Michigan, a city where the government and national health organizations fudged data and ignored a suffering population. Dr. Mona Hanna Atisha, a pediatrician who's based in Flint, joins us this hour to tell the story of a city in crisis. We'll talk with her about her patients, the children who faced the disastrous and permanent health consequences from drinking water they were told was clean, and about how the government is scrambling to address the irreversible damage it caused. Our conversation starts after a short break. When pediatrician Mona Hanna Atisha, or Dr. Mona as her patients know her, first heard whispers of problems with the tap water in Flint, Michigan, she was slow to judgment. It was 2014, and the city of Flint had just switched water sources from Lake Huron to the Flint River. Although the river had once been a dumping ground for toxic waste, she trusted the officials when they told people the water was clean and drinkable. She watched Michigan Governor Rick Snyder drink a glass of it on TV, and she reassured her young patients and their worried parents that it was safe. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Still, the whispers got louder, and soon she started seeing the first symptoms of a community poisoned by lead consumption. What she found was horrifying. Since the water source had switched, the number of kids with high levels lead levels in their blood had doubled. With the government seemingly ignoring the people of Flint, she could not stay silent. She went public with her findings and has been advocating for the people of Flint on a national level ever since. Her new book is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Dr. Mona, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Courtney.
So there's a lot of you and your family in this book. Your family left Iraq when Saddam Hussein was coming to power. Why did you decide to integrate your upbringing and your Iraqi heritage into this retelling of what happened in Flint?
Yeah, so this is a strange book. This is not just a book about the Flint water crisis. It is very much my memoir. It's a first-person book about my role in this crisis, the uncovering of this crisis, and very much in our resistance and our model of hope that we are building. But to understand me, to understand my role, to understand my values, you had to learn about me. And my immigrant lens, being a first-generation Iraqi-American immigrant, being a child who was every day grateful to be in this country, a child who also very much knew what injustice looked like from what was happening back home, where I very much understood what people in power could do to vulnerable populations. So that is weaved into the story because it informs who I am and it really informs my work. So it is this book is a mix of a lot of things. It's definitely a lot about Flint, but it's also a positive immigrant story, which is something I think we need very much right now.
What was Flint like when your family first moved to the area?
Yeah, so we moved to the Metro Detroit area when I was about, we first moved to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is actually 12 hours away from the Lower Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And then we came downstate when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And at that time, Flint was beginning to see the demise of the auto industry. In the 1980s is when General Motors started to disinvest from the city, moving auto plants outside of the city, outside of the country, moving to automation. So that was the very beginnings of the crisis of the city. The water crisis is really built on top of decades of crisis in Flint. And that's what drew me back to the city to serve as a pediatrician. I wanted to be at a place where I could make a difference in the lives of children who needed it the most. And our Flint kids were definitely already suffering from every socioeconomic, environmental obstacle.
Can you paint a bit of a picture of the poverty in Flint? It's pervasive, and people who haven't spent much time there might not know exactly how bad things are for so many families.
Yeah, so we have an almost 60% poverty rate for our children, 60. One of the highest unemployment rates in the country, one of the highest violent crime rates. We have no full-service grocery stores. We have a drastic drop in our population, which affects our tax base and thus the services of our city. Every disparity you can imagine we have in Flint because of these socioeconomic issues that fundamentally began from disinvestment and then unemployment and then poverty and racism, violence, every obstacle for children's success. And all of these in the world of pediatrics, we consider toxicities. These are all toxic stresses that are known to cause really lifelong impacts on the development and the health outcomes of children.
And I hate to ask you for a specific number just out of your book, but I was really chilled by the life expectancy difference between Flint and just a neighboring community. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, and this is not only specific to Flint, but in Flint, like in many of our communities in this country, the zip code you are born in is the greatest predictor of where you will end up. And in Flint, if you are born in a Flint zip code, you have a 15-year less life expectancy than a child born in an adjacent neighboring zip code. And that is not right, and that is not equitable. And that is happening all over this country. There's really great maps and great research that actually have looked at cities like subway stops, and one subway stop versus another subway stop has 10 to 20 years of differences in life expectancy purely because of the environment of where those children are growing up in.
Just for the sake of some background, so Flint switched in 2014 from Lake Huron as a water source to Flint River as a water source. And that decision wasn't really made by the city's elected mayor, but by an appointed emergency manager. Why did this happen and why was that significant?
That's a great question, and that's so important to the story. Flint had lost democracy. So the Flint story is ultimately a democracy story. So Flint was in this dire economic state near bankruptcy. And in 2011, the state appointed an emergency manager to fix Flint's finances. And that emergency manager's only goal was austerity. It was to save money. How can we cut costs with really no regard for public health or children's health? And the emergency manager decided in 2014 that the water we had been getting from the Great Lakes was too expensive and that we would start drawing water from the local Flint River. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with Michigan, Michigan is literally in the middle of the Great Lakes. Flint is surrounded by the Great Lakes, which happens to be the largest source of fresh water in the world. 20% of the fresh water in the world is around Flint. But that was deemed too expensive for this city that was predominantly poor and predominantly minority. So we switched to the Flint River as a temporary move until a new pipeline to the Great Lakes was to be built. The Flint River itself was not the problem. It was a difficult water source to manage. But the criminality of the story is that the water was not treated properly. It was not treated with an ingredient called corrosion control so that the lead that was in our plumbing would not come out of our plumbing.
So tell me about, you'd ask questions by patients and parents before, well, I guess not always by patients because some of them are very young, but by their parents before about tap water in Flint and had always felt pretty comfortable saying it's fine, please don't waste your money on bottled water, drink what we've got. The officials have all certified that it's clean and potable. Tell me about the night that you hosted a barbecue with two of your high school friends and their families and how things started to change for you on that night.
Yeah, so this book really recounts all of these stories, the interactions I had with my patients, my everyday interactions, reassuring them that the water is okay, even though that in their gut, these moms and dads knew that there was something wrong with this water. But I was being reassured by the state and telling them that everything was okay. But that all changed at my home at a barbecue with high school girlfriends. And one of my high school girlfriends, Elin Batanzo, happens to be a water expert. And she cornered me in my kitchen, both of us with a glass of wine in our hand. And she's like, Mona, and her eyes were boring into mine. And she's like, you know, what have you heard about the water in Flint? I'm like, it's okay. I just saw patients. I'm telling them it's okay. And she's like, well, it's not okay. And Elin formerly worked at the EPA. She worked at the EPA in Washington, D.C. about a decade ago when Washington, D.C. had a very similar lead and water crisis. And she had seen a recent memo by a former colleague of hers at the EPA that was warning about Flint's lead levels and that this was really an oncoming crisis. So she shared with me that night that the water wasn't being treated properly, and because of that, there would be lead in the water. And that was the very first time I heard the word lead. I heard about the color issues and the odor and the smell, and I heard about bacteria, and I heard about all these other issues with the water. But I never heard the word lead. And when a pediatrician or anybody in public health hears the word lead, we kind of freak out.
Is there ever a safe limit for lead in the water? Can there be lead in water, and can it be deemed safe?
That's a great question, too. So, no. Incredible science has taught us that there is no safe level of lead. The EPA has a maximum contaminant goal for lead in water, which is 0 parts per billion. However, that is not achievable because we have lead in our plumbing. So we were stubbornly slow as a nation to restrict lead in our plumbing. Lead is in our service lines, which are the pipes that go from the water mains to the front of our house. That was allowable until 1986. But lead was actually allowed in fixtures and faucets until 2014. So there is lead in all of our plumbing, especially in the Northeast and Midwest. And the laws on the book that regulate lead in water, the lead and copper rule, have not caught up with the science that we now know of no safe level of lead. The action level for lead in water for a public water system is set at 15 parts per billion. And that is not a health-based action level. That is based on the feasibility of a water system. So another lesson of Flint and a lesson of this book is that we need to update these regulations. We need them to really catch up with the incredible science that we have right now to fully protect people, because in this nation, we were never intended to have lead-free water.
So if the action level is 15 parts per billion, which you're saying is not safe in and of itself, what were some of the readings, the private readings that were done early, like in Flint, compared to that action level of 15? What was coming back?
In the hundreds and thousands of parts per billion. We had a home in Flint with a lead level of 22,000 parts per billion. I think my lowest day in this whole crisis was when we found out that a home adjacent to the hospital, which was a home for foster kids and neglected kids and troubled kids, had a lead level of 5,000 parts per billion. This corrosive, untreated water ate up our pipes, and the folks at the EPA said it was like drinking through a lead-painted straw, and you never knew when a piece of that corroded lead scale would come off into the drinking water and into the bodies of our children.
What are some of the symptoms of lead contamination, and what can it do to your body?
So lead exposure is known as a silent pediatric epidemic, and that gets it to the title of my book, What the Eyes Don't See. So quite literally, we do not see lead in water. It's colorless, it's odorless, it's tasteless. But we also do not see acutely the symptoms of lead exposure. It is subclinical. No child these days presents with acute intoxication where they have like seizures or comas. What we see are these chronic symptoms that present years, if not decades later. And it is a potent, irreversible neurotoxin that attacks the core of what it means to be a person. It impacts cognition, so actually drops IQ levels. It impacts behavior, leads to things like attention deficit disorder, developmental delays. And it's even been linked to impulsivity and criminality. So we now know through great science, through the fields of epidemiology, environmental health, toxicology, that there is no safe level of lead. And we also now know that levels we thought were okay back in the day, that even the very lowest levels can cause the steepest decline in children's cognition and behavior.
And a lot of it depends on when this contamination happens. If we have a 6-month-old baby guzzling formula that's been mixed with tap water, we're going to have a different situation than if someone who is 12 was drinking the water. And by the time you know, I mean, you can't do much, can you?
Absolutely. And lead in water, unlike other sources of lead, which are all evil, lead paint, lead dust, lead soil, we deal with a lot of these legacy sources of lead because they persist in our environment. But lead in water impacts an even younger and a more developmentally vulnerable age group. It crosses in utero, so it affects that unborn child whose brain is just developing. And most are those babies on formula. So we have terribly low breastfeeding rates in Flint, just like in many of our inner cities. And those babies who are drinking this water mixed with powder, got hit the most.
Our guest this hour is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Her book is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372 or tweet us at KERATHINK. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Listening to Think, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Her book is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. So Dr. Mona, you were really central to kind of exposing the water crisis in Flint. But after that very first conversation you had with your friend who had some knowledge of the water issues before they were really even spoken about, how did your work as a pediatrician change? How did you start treating patients differently when you just had this little kernel of worry?
Yeah. So like I said, right when I heard about the word, the possibility of lead in our water, I stopped sleeping, I stopped eating, and I really began this quest to find out if that lead in the water was getting into the bodies of our children. And you don't mess with lead, especially when it comes to kids. So from that point forward, every patient interaction I had was based on the public health principle of precaution, err on the side of caution. So, you know, even though my patients, many of them thought the water was okay because they were being told it was okay, from that point onward, no, don't use this water. Don't bathe your baby in this water. Don't mix your baby's formula this water. Don't drink this, you know, instead of other beverages. So from that point forward, it was, you know, err on the side of caution and do not use this water until we have more evidence.
And you were really, this became a true quest for you. I mean, it was eating up all of your time. I mean, this was, and you started to kind of slowly build a team of allies in this pursuit. Can you kind of explain to us how you started on this mission to expose this and fix it?
Yeah, so the story very much kind of goes through this crisis and what happened. But the story is so applicable today because it's a story of activism, of resistance, and it is a story of standing up, opening your eyes, building a team of folks around you, and making the world a better place in your community. So when I found out that there was the possibility of lead in water, I knew I needed the data in my pocket. I knew I needed to find out if that was getting into the bodies of our children. I tried to get that surveillance data from both the state and the county and couldn't. So in rapid speed, built a team of folks around me to do the research on our hospital records to see if the blood lead levels of children had changed. And it had changed. So unlike anything that was happening in our nation, our state, and our city, the lead levels of the children of Flint, based on screening data, had increased after the water switch, whereas there was no change in lead levels of children who weren't getting this water. And in areas where the water lead levels were the highest, we saw the greatest increase in the children's lead levels. So that my team grew even more once we had this data. It grew with allies that I wouldn't initially consider to be allies. So very much in our professional lives, we work with people who are of our same profession. And I used to think before this crisis that pediatricians almost had a monopoly on caring for children. Like, who else cares about kids more than pediatricians? Well, there's a lot of folks do. And my good friend became a water expert who cared about kids more than I did. And journalists and moms and activists and pastors and an EPA scientist and all these different folks from different backgrounds and different professions and different ideologies and different political parties came together to take a stand collectively to expose this crisis and to set the path to recovery. So I think that's one of the most important lessons of this book is that we can make a difference even when we think we are alone and we are fighting something alone, we are not.
And it was quite a fight. It was not easy for you to get a lot of the data that you wanted. Did you have a lot of unreturned phone calls and unanswered emails?
Yeah, absolutely. So I hit so many roadblocks in this process. You know, the lead levels of children are part of surveillance programs. The state has these numbers. They have these levels. The county health department had these levels. And I was trying to get these this information from folks whose job was to track this, and I couldn't get this information. Roadblocks everywhere. And I could not understand how people slept at night. I had stopped sleeping at this point because of the urgency of the situation. And I couldn't understand why people were not getting back to me, why they couldn't hear the alarm bells in my head that I could not silence.
So you built this team around you. Tell me a little bit about some of the independent, you know, researchers you worked with who were doing their own testing. And how did this all come together? How did you find the people that you aligned yourself with?
Yeah, so the lead in the water was being investigated by a renowned water scientist named Mark Edwards. He's from Virginia Tech University. He actually uncovered the lead in water crisis in Washington, D.C. about a decade ago. He's like a world-leading expert on lead in water and corrosion. So when he found out that Flint wasn't treating its water properly, he was actually contacted by an amazing mom who said the state wasn't listening to them, that she had high levels of lead in her water, her children had elevated lead levels. When he found that out, he literally packed his minivan overnight with graduate students and with supplies and drove up to Flint from Virginia to work with the people of Flint to do something called citizen science to prove that there was lead in the water. And that's what they did. They went around the city, they collected samples, and they transparently reported all of these elevated levels of lead in Flint's water. And he was sharing science. He was sharing facts, and he was attacked just as I was attacked later on. The state actually called him a magician, that he was pulling rabbits out of hats for, like, wherever he would go, he would just pull lead out of water. So Flint is another example of science, of the disrespect for science. Fundamental basic science was denied in Flint, not just lead levels in water and lead levels in blood, but the basic science of corrosion. So just a few months into this water switch, a full year before my research came out, General Motors, which was born in Flint and still has plants in Flint, stopped using this water because it was corroding their engine parts. And they got a bypass to go back to Great Lakes water, where the people of Flint were told to relax, that everything was okay. So basic science was denied. You didn't need water lead levels. You didn't need blood lead levels to know that there was something wrong with this water.
So once you had enough data that you thought was significant, like a large enough sample of data to really present something, I mean, you made a big presentation. You really kind of wanted the local government, the state government to be with you on these findings and make an announcement. How did that go over when you presented it to people for the first time?
Not too good. So I did something called a form of academic disobedience. So those of us in medicine and in academia, we do not present research at a press conference. And that's what we did with this research. It had not gone through the traditional peer review process because that takes months, and our kids did not have another day. So we presented this research at a press conference. We shared our findings that the lead levels in the children had increased, and that, you know, we needed to declare a health advisory. We needed to switch back to treated Great Lakes water. And right away, the state attacked my science, attacked my credibility. And I should not have been surprised, because for 18 months, they had been attacking and dismissing and denying the people of Flint, the moms, the activists, the pastors, the journalists, the water scientists. Everybody who had tried to raise any kind of concern about this water was attacked. And thus, when I shared my findings, I was attacked as well.
One thing I saw happen a lot when I read about people's reactions to what you were presenting was they love to blame it on the pipes. It's the pipes in the houses.
Yeah.
It's not.
Blame
it's
the
not,
victim.
Yeah, exactly. And that's for people who are poor and who are either renting or who own. I mean, how are they supposed to say that's not true?
Oh, that is so true. So there was a lot of blame the victim. And that actually is part of the history of lead. The lead industry was absolutely evil, put lead in paint, put lead in gasoline, and sometimes mandated it, for example, in the paint of public housing. And when children had elevated lead levels, they blamed the families. They blamed often the demographics of the population, saying that this was a ghetto problem, that they weren't clean enough, that it was their problem and their fault for this to happen. So this was a classic continuation of blaming the victim, where it doesn't you know, no matter where the lead is in your environment, if it's there, it's going to get into our children. And it is not their fault. It is not the people's fault that they had lead in their plumbing. It is the fault that this water wasn't treated properly. That's how it got into our children.
So after the big press conference, which, as you said, was kind of an act of academic disobedience, what was kind of the confluence of events following that? What happened?
Yeah, so, you know, when the state attacks you and tells you you're wrong, it's hard not to believe them. So for a moment, I actually felt that I was wrong, and I was scared, and I thought I had made the biggest mistake of my life. And I literally was under the covers in my bed, you know, wishing I could have rewinded. But that lasted a short period because the numbers in my research, you know, which was all, you know, spreadsheets and statistics and numbers, those numbers were kids. And every single one of those numbers was a kid that I probably took care of in that last year or so. And those kids literally got me out of bed and got me back in this fight. This wasn't about me. This wasn't about how I felt. This was about them, and this was about their future. And we had double checked and triple checked our science. We knew the numbers did not lie. So we fought back. We fought back with more evidence. We fought back with more science. And ultimately, the truth of our science spoke truth to power. And the state finally conceded that, yes, there was a lead problem, that they went back and looked at their surveillance data. And it actually did show very similar, you know, elevations as my data. And we switched back to treated water within a month.
And was there a turning point when you felt like the whole country kind of noticed and believed you? I mean, I don't think there's a person in America now in 2018 who hasn't heard about the Flint water crisis and doesn't understand it, at least on some basic level. When did it change from you're wrong, to, oh, my gosh, America's watching now?
Yeah, so I think the state held a press conference a few weeks after my press conference where they admitted that, yes, there was a problem. And I think ultimately, you know, when they conceded, when they said, yes, you know, that is, you know, our data is consistent with her data. There is a problem. You know, we're going to work to fix this. So that happened, you know, towards the end of 2015.
And once the water supply was switched, did things improve?
Great question. So why is the water still not safe right now? You know, this happened a long time ago. Why didn't things improve right away? So, you know, we were on this corrosive untreated water for 18 months, and it literally ate up our pipes and our plumbing. So we are in the process of getting our lead pipes replaced, and that takes time. So in Flint right now, we've replaced about 6,000 of those lead pipes. We have about 9,000 to go. And until those pipes are replaced, people need to remain on the filtered water and bottled water.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're going to go to a call now. We're going to hear from Rita in Dallas. Rita, go ahead with your question.
No, Mona, what I was wondering is how one would account for, say, levels of intelligence or developmental delays among, say, siblings born in the same zip code, in the same family, drinking the same water, or, say, kids in the same neighborhood who were all born in the neighborhood, and yet you would have some that might be developmentally delayed and some that were geniuses, and how could you blame that then on the water?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the question was about really the causation. How can you prove that this was because of the water? And you can't. With many environmental health conditions, especially lead, you cannot prove that it was because of the lead. And that's where the field of epidemiology and population health comes in. All the research on lead is done on this large population health level that looks at populations over time and changes in, you know, cognition and behavior over time. We are trying to do that work. We have launched something called the Flint Registry, where we are identifying folks that were exposed, and we're going to be seeing how they're doing long term, but not to see the consequences of this water crisis, but really to see how we're able to intervene and mitigate the consequences of this crisis. You know, two children can present with the exact same, for example, lead levels, raised in the same environment.
one child can go on to Harvard and one child may need special ed. So there's a lot of other factors, protective factors and risk factors that impact children's development. And in Flint right now, and this gets to kind of the story of hope that we are doing, in Flint right now, we are trying to tip the scales with protective factors. So we have implemented so many science-based interventions to not see the consequences of this crisis. For example, investing in early education, early literacy, healthcare access, nutrition support, all of these things promote children's development and will hopefully mitigate all of these complications.
I have to imagine one of the toughest things for you as a physician was, as this was all ongoing, as the taps were still running from the river, you know, you're still seeing patients, at least certain days of the week, you're seeing patients in the hospital and treating them. Could you see things happening that you suspected were a result of them drinking Flint water?
Not really. So that also, you know, if I gets back to the title, what the eyes don't see, we don't see the symptoms of lead exposure. We talked a lot about lead, but that was not the only thing that was going on in this water. The first manifestations of issues with this water were actually skin issues. We had bacteria in the water, and then a lot of chlorine was added. That irritated people's skin and eyes. And then because there was so much chlorine in the water, we had a buildup of a chlorine byproduct called total trihalomethanes, which you can't even say, but that's a long-term carcinogen. It causes cancer. Then we had an outbreak of Legionnaire's disease, and people actually died from the pneumonia of Legionnaires because of this untreated water. And thus now we have negligent homicide charges against folks responsible. So lead is one of the traumas of this crisis, but this crisis is bigger and broader. It's a crisis also of betrayal, of anger, of lack of trust, of fear, of anxiety, and just having those emotions, those stresses can also lead to chronic conditions.
And I'm guessing that because this was ongoing for so long, and because you know as a physician what can happen if lead is introduced, especially in a young child, do you spend a lot of time worrying about the future and patients that seem okay, what may or may not happen to them down the road? I mean, I know in the book you talked a lot about remembering this baby that was about to switch to formula. Does that haunt you even now?
Absolutely. It haunts me, and it haunts every single parent that comes into clinic. Every single day, the question is my child going to be okay? And what we do as pediatricians is a lot of reassurance. And we reassure our families that, especially if you connect them to all these incredible resources that we've brought in, you know, the literacy, the parenting support, the high-quality childcare, the preschool, the healthcare access, and love them and hug them and talk to them and read to them, do all these things that you should do anyways for your children, you know, we hope to mitigate some of that anxiety and stress that we see every day.
We're speaking with Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Her book is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. The number to call to join the conversation is 800-933-5372. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Our guest is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, who wrote What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. And it focuses on her role as a pediatrician in the Flint water crisis. One thing I wanted to ask you about, Dr. Mona, is so we have a neighborhood in town called West Dallas that used to have an old battery and lead smelter plant that leached lead into, I think it was air, water, and soil several decades ago. So that's all been cleaned up now, but how long do problems of this environmental scale linger in an area, even when cleanup is, you know, quote unquote, complete?
Yeah, so a long time. So lead is a heavy metal. It persists. So the cleanup may have happened, but the consequences can last for generations. You know, lead impacts, you know, your entire life course trajectory. We also have learned about the epigenetic impact of lead, where lead can actually impact your genome and how, you know, and that can actually be passed on to generations. So it was really incredible science that has come out that talks about the long long-term consequences of this exposure and really how difficult it is to get it out of our environment. It persists.
And we spoke to this a bit earlier in the conversation, but why are people living in poverty at such a disadvantage when it comes to health outcomes?
For so many reasons. In pediatrics, I think the most important concept that we are looking at now is the concept of early adversity, of adverse childhood experiences and toxic stresses. And that is so profound in children in poverty. So we have so many kids in this country who are living with so many toxicities. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because it's way more than just about Flint. It is about kids everywhere growing up with insurmountable adversities. And those toxicities include the toxicity of poverty, the toxicity of, you know, lack of nutrition, of, you know, of violence exposure, of incarcerated parents, of child abuse, of neglect, of separated parents. All of these things are toxicities that alter a children's brain structure, alter their genetics, their neurological system, their hormonal system, and that we now know leave these lifelong scars. And poverty really is at the root of all of that. So in pediatrics, we now recognize the incredible role that poverty plays on the trajectory of children. So now in our clinic, as pediatricians, not only do we screen for hearing and vision, we screen for poverty. We screen for these environmental situations that have an even greater impact on a child's life than any medical thing that I can diagnose or prescribe for children.
Most people that grew up kind of traditional middle class probably remember regularly seeing their doctors. But can you describe the typical relationship between poor families and physicians?
Yeah, so our poor families, they care and love their children just like all of us do. And yet they have every obstacle in the world to do what is best for their kids. And those obstacles are because of poverty. So in our clinic in Flint, we have about a 20 to 30% no-show rate. So parents, you know, they make appointments, but they can't come to their appointments. And it is not their fault. It is because they have every obstacle of poverty, from lack of transportation to lack of childcare, to all these other social and emotional and mental health issues that make it impossible for them to get what their children need.
And I wonder in general just about infrastructure neglect. I mean, whether it's a water line issue or leaky gas lines or just sidewalks missing where there should be sidewalks. Does kind of neglect in poor communities of how they're actually built, the bones of those communities, does that contribute to health problems?
Absolutely. So if there's no safe places to play, you're going to have higher rates of obesity because kids can't go outside and play and you know, be physically active. So this is one of the most fundamental issues of children's development and their health is their environments that they grow up in. If there's no grocery stores and it's all fast food places, that's part of the environment. They're going to be more unhealthy. If they live by a polluted site or, you know, a factory and the air quality is worse, they're going to be more unhealthy. So what happened in Flint is also a story of these larger environmental injustices, because it is predominantly poor people and people of color who disproportionately suffer from environmental burdens. And that's not just Flint, that is everywhere.
And to that end, can you expound on what environmental racism is?
Sure. So environmental racism is the concept that people of color disproportionately suffer from environmental burdens. And even before this water crisis, as pediatricians, we knew that lead exposure, lead poisoning was a form of environmental racism. Our kids in Flint already had higher lead levels, just like our kids in Detroit and Chicago and Baltimore and Philadelphia. Some of our country's most vulnerable children, who are also predominantly of color, are already burdened with environmental pollution.
And do you think race was a factor specifically in what happened with Flint?
Absolutely. And that's been well investigated and well reported. This never would have happened in a whiter or richer population. We talked early in the show about the emergency management rule. At one point, 50% of African Americans in the state, compared to 2% of whites, were under emergency management. So it's been clearly articulated that this crisis not only began, but was prolonged because of the demographics of the population.
I want to talk a little bit about the officials that were behind some of this information not getting where it needed to go. And so I think we're actually going to start with a call. We're going to hear from Mark in Grand Prairie. So, Mark, can you go ahead with your question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. What will happen to the Republican-appointed supervisor who chose economics over the health of the people he was supervising and put pressure on the engineers and health officials to lie?
Do you know the answer to that question?
Yeah, so the emergency manager has been charged with many charges, including the negligent homicide charges for the Legionella deaths. There's been over a dozen criminal charges at many levels of government, including at the state level, the Water Quality Department, the Health Department, and at the city level. So those are all in process. There was actually trials yesterday, ongoing trials, to get at that accountability. And that accountability is so critically important for the people of Flint. I often see our recovery as a form of a truth and reconciliation. We need to know what happened. Then there's a role for restorative justice, and then we can kind of move on to that healing.
Do you think, as far as kind of the quote-unquote cover-up goes, were some people not really aware of what was going on, or were most people just protecting a bottom line?
Well, I look forward to all of the investigations that really can uncover that. But yeah, there was clear cover-up. So we later learned that the bloodlet data that I was after was actually already investigated at the state level, and they had seen a spike in children's bloodlet levels, and that was covered up. The water lead levels, they knew were elevated, but they threw out the high numbers because they didn't want their percent, their, you know, their action level to be high. So there was cover-up that did happen, and that's the root of some of the charges.
And even just some of the testing could kind of be manipulated or changed to kind of shroud the results, right? Tell me a little bit about like flushing or testing at the source and some of that stuff.
That is a great question, and I've learned so much about this. So water testing is so nuanced. You can test a tap 10 different times and get 10 different results based on the time of day, based on the season of the year. The summer hot temperatures increase lead in water, which is why you're never supposed to use hot water for cooking or drinking. Depends on the flow rate, how fast you're getting the water out of tap. It also depends on the opening of the bottle that you're collecting from. It depends if it's the first draw sample, so if the water's been sitting overnight or if you've already flushed. It depends on whether you've taken out the aerator, which is the end of your kind of fixture or not. So there's so many different things that you can do to minimize the capture of lead in water. And during this crisis, the state was really employing all of those loopholes to minimize the amount of lead that it was capturing to make it seem that there wasn't a problem.
And one thing that I noticed several times when you spoke to politicians was how often politics came right into the conversation. And I'm not talking about party, but I'm talking about the second the crisis would emerge, someone would seize on how they'd always said there'd been a lead problem in Flint. You know, they were talking about paint. But how come people had such a hard time just seeing this straight on and had to kind of put it in the realm of what they were doing for their job politically?
Yeah, so what the eyes don't see. So it was a conscious blindness. So, you know, and that gets at also beyond Flint. It's about people and problems and places we just don't want to see. We don't want to hear about. Like, let's just deny this problem for as long as possible and move on. So that's not right. We need to, you know, part of the moral of the story and why I wrote this book is that it is all of our responsibility to open our eyes and open each other's eyes to the problems and the injustices that are around us everywhere. And it's not political. It's our children's future that we're talking about.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're going to take one more call now. Let's go to Gary in Fort Worth. Gary, you go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Mona, for standing up and sticking with it. The whole country appreciates people like you.
Thank you.
My question has to do with filtering. Is there a special filter for lead, filtering out lead?
Yes, there is a special filter for filtering out lead. It is a National Sanitation Foundation lead clearing filter. The designation is 53, so NSF 53 lead clearing filter. You can buy them at, you know, any kind of hardware store or online. The most important thing is to attach the lead clearing filter at the point of use. So right at the end of your kitchen tap, right at the end of the faucet. So it prevents any lead that might be after that point. So you don't want a filter that is, you know, before the end of your faucet. You want it right at the end of your faucet. You can also get a pitcher filter. So the filter will clear water through the pitcher. But yeah, there are lead clearing filters, and those are all distributed in Flint.
But you can't just go to Target and buy any Brita and think that every metal is out of your water.
No, it has to be a specific NSF 53 lead clearing filter.
Tell me a little bit about how the community has reacted to all of this. I'm sure this crisis has hit every family a little bit differently. But, you know, as you continue to move forward, I mean, what do you hear now from parents and patients? Have they ideologically just, do they not trust anymore? Are people positive? What's kind of the vibe?
It's a mix of sentiment. The reason I love being in Flint and the reason that I work in Flint is because of the people of Flint. And they are brave and they are strong and they are smart and they are absolutely resilient. Flint is a city that has rolled up their sleeves in the commitment not to be defined by this crisis, but really to be defined by our recovery. We are doing things right now in our recovery that aren't being done anywhere else. And that is what we hope that people go away with, of how Flint, you know, recovered and bounced back and led the nation in that respect. But you know, I would, you know, this is just, it's still a trauma. It's an ongoing trauma. People are still on bottled water. They're still on filtered water. There is massive distrust, and rightly so. The people of Flint were betrayed by every level of government that was meant to protect them. And this is on top of being betrayed really for decades in the city. So it's going to take a long time for that trust to come back. But the people of Flint have rolled up their sleeves, and we are committed to make sure that our children have the brightest future possible.
Was it hard for you to transition from physician and head of the residency program and teacher to advocate and activist? Was it a tough leap to make, or did it feel natural?
This is my job. Everything I am doing is part of my job as a pediatrician. It is my duty and my obligation as a pediatrician to be an advocate for my children. This is how I was trained. This is how I train my pediatricians. It is our duty to speak up for kids, especially for children in populations where their voices has been muffled and silenced.
And I'm not implying in any way that there's a lot of massive lead water cover-ups going on right now in America, but what would you say to, you know, another physician in a poor community or a public health worker or someone who interacts with people that sees something suspicious and worrisome and doesn't really know how to move forward with their concerns? I mean, how do you start taking this seriously and trying to affect change when you're just one person?
Yeah, so, you know, something that I learned very on in my medical training is that moms are always right. So listen to your patients. Listen to their concerns, their valid concerns. Believe in them and develop a partnership and a rapport with your patients so that you can work together to overcome these kinds of problems. Build a team. This is a story about a team that came together. And your team might not be what you expect your team to be, but there's folks out there who care about the same thing that you do. And often you think you're fighting a fight alone, but you never are. I also relied on my greater kind of pediatric and public health community, and there was a lot of folks who had my back and who had Flint's back. So you're never alone. Find your people, and never be afraid to fight for what is right. It is scary. It is hard. Your heart rate goes up. There was a knot in my stomach that wouldn't go away. But when you are fighting for what's right, you have to persist.
My guest this hour is Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. Her book is called What the Eyes Don't See, A Story of Crisis, Resistance, and Hope in an American City. Dr. Mona, thank you so much for your time. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Courtney, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer, with help on the boards today from Alan Roberts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can also subscribe to our podcast and find out about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.